I just at times felt like how I played directly reflected who I was as a person. You know, I felt like when I played bad, when I, you know, would shoot over par and I would like feel happy afterwards, I shut that down so quickly because I felt like I didn't deserve to be happy if I shot bad on the course.
That's Michelle Wee West. We've all been watching Michelle on the golf course for decades. Now at 32, she's wrapping up her groundbreaking career and recently took the time to connect with No Off Season about the many ways mental health and the life of a professional athlete converge. I'm Dr. Shairi Turner. Michelle first started receiving national attention for her incredible golf skills at the age of 10. She qualified for her first professional tour event at the age of 12 and went on to become a U.S. Women's Open champion. Now, as a new mom, a player director on the LPGA board, and a member of Nike's athlete think tank, Michelle is using her voice to impact systemic change. Her priorities, as we discuss, include athlete mental health and more opportunities for BIPOC golfers. For Michelle, learning to use her voice and to stand up for progress has been a journey directly tied to important social and mental health issues. Among them, she talks about establishing hard-earned boundaries, facing panic and anxiety, separating personal identity from professional success, and even digging into uncomfortable territory to meet a critical moment in history as a member of the AAPI community. In telling her story, Michelle presents an admirable combination of tenderness and resolve that makes me understand the complexity of her life as a golfer even better and makes me excited for her future as a leader. So, Michelle, thank you for being with me on No Off Season. It seems like you have lived a lifetime already in your three decades here. There are so many moments and lessons from your extraordinary and groundbreaking golf career that tie into mental health. So I want to start with a question that examines, you know, that period of your life. You joined the professional tour just before turning 16. You're now 32 and recently announced your decision to pretty much step away from competing. And I'm curious about how you think the discussion about mental health has changed over the years for athletes and what can be said now as compared to what couldn't be said back then when you started.
You know, I felt like when I started, you know, mental health wasn't really talked about. What was talked about was having a champion mindset, you know, being strong, being a warrior. That included never breaking. That included never resting. You know, that included laser focused. So in my mind, seeing that, I felt like to be a champion golfer, I had to have that mindset. I had to have that mindset that never broke, that never complained. You know, when I hit my first injury, I remember like always saying like, you know, my bones may have physically broken, but it's not going to break me mentally. So I felt like if I had, you know, admitted that I was, you know, I had PTSD from that, I had, you know, I was going through that, then I was just not a champion golfer anymore. I remember like not telling the media, like, you know, really honest answers about my injuries, kind of hiding it just because I didn't want to, like, you know, feel weak. And, you know, later on in my career when I was going through more injuries and, you know, just being honest about it, just, you know, being like, this hurts. I don't know how much longer I'm going to play. It was actually freeing because I felt like I didn't have to put up a front, you know, during my hardest times. So it was definitely tough, but I'm really glad that, you know, athletes now are really stepping out and showing that you can be a champion, but also admit that you're fragile, admit that, you know, you're not perfect.
It's an amazing time to be able to acknowledge mental health in that way. And, you know, and in your lifetime to have seen it such a change, right? Because you started, wow, at the age of 10, right? And really were engaged in golfing at such a young age and in the spotlight. How do you remember dealing with that intense pressure as a young person in an individual sport that required such a degree of mental focus?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. I think individual sports are hard because there's really no one else that, you know, kind of goes through what you're going through. There's no teammate to lean on. Like, of course, you have your team and your caddy, but, you know, you're the only one inside the ropes kind of pulling the shots. But I think that was a big decision of why my parents made such an emphasis for me to stay in school and to go to college, to go to Stanford, you know, because they knew that none of my friends in middle school or high school, even before I turned pro, knew what anything about golf. I mean, they still don't. So it was really nice to be able to go from the golf course and then just be a normal 15, 16, 18, 19, 20 year old off the golf course. So kind of having that almost like dual life really saved me mentally. And it was almost like I just block out, you know, I just kind of would leave the office and go on campus and be a completely normal person.
That's a great point, because my next question was going to be, what were the types of mental health tools and support that are available or most useful to young athletes and other young people who are pursuing areas with such an intense focus? So what are some of the tools that you would say you leaned into?
Yeah, you know, I tried journaling. That was not it for me. I am not a journaler.
Right.
I've tried on many occasions. I have a lot of journals that have nothing in them, because I was like, okay, today is the day I'm going to start journaling and writing down my feelings. And it just, you know, it felt silly to do it. Just not for me. You know, for me, I found painting really helped. Cooking, got a dog in 2009. And that was just a huge help to travel with the dog. And it was nice to see a lot of the girls that travel with dogs now. I think pets are a great form of, you know, emotional therapy. I think just finding hobbies and finding things that you can do that takes your mind off of it. You know, another one for me is, I guess I love watching scary movies. Like after a bad day, it's the first thing that I do is I just go back home and watch a scary movie. It's the only thing that allows me to not think about anything else.
And I think that's so important, such an important point to elevate, because we hear things like journaling, right? And it's what you just identified is how individualized our own mental health toolkit really is. So to be able mm-hmm. to say, these are the things that bring me peace, right? It may not be what brings someone else peace or calm or brings me support. I just love that you raise that, because people feel like there's a certain way mm-hmm. that one has to have or seek or find mental health support. And it really is whatever helps you in the moment, right? And
yeah.
And I can imagine perhaps it was different when you were younger, as got older and progressed through your career, perhaps like the supports changed in some way.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, sometimes some days it was watching Hostel 1, 2, and 3 back to back to back. Sometimes that was my, you know, mental health toolkit. Sometimes it was making pasta. It just differs. Like you said, it's everyone has their own individualistic, routine and steps that they do. But I think it's just important just to try, you know, even if journaling or whatever isn't the thing for you, I think it's important to try and to realize that maybe you do need something. And, you know, even if it doesn't work out, I think it's important to keep trying and keep trying to find new things.
Yeah, find what works for you, mm-hmm. right? As we're rounding out this incredible podcast series, I can't help but reflect on how it's really been valuable for our listeners to hear both the highs and the lows when it comes to the mental health journeys of our athletes, because how we feel is really a part of both of those types of moments. One of the biggest moments in your career was winning the U.S. Women's Open in 2014 when you were just 24. And how did winning a major like that impact your mindset going forward? Did it create more pressure, or did you feel more self-assured and empowered? And what were the tools you kind of used to process that incredible moment?
I think after I won the US Open, you know, I just felt like I was a champion. I achieved my biggest dream, and, you know, my expectations were different than everyone else's expectation. You know, everyone's expectation was, now that I've won one, I need to win 10 more. You know, and I just realized that it's never going to be enough. I'm never going to do enough that will make everyone happy. And in my mind, my two biggest goals in life, my career life, were, you know, graduate from Stanford and winning the US Open. And, you know, I did both those things. So from then on, I was like, you know, everything is a bonus from here on out for me. And I kind of went in with that mindset. Obviously, I had, you know, expectations for myself and desires to win more. But there was a feeling of self-assurance, knowing that I accomplished what I wanted to accomplish.
Yeah. And that's an incredible set of boundaries, right? For someone who is an athlete who had been in sport for so long. And, you know, it's the expectation that, right, as a professional athlete, you win one and you're going to go for everything indefinitely until your body, you know, we've seen athletes, bodies are broken, right? Because the drive, whether it's external or internal, is to do more, right? And what I'm hearing you say that I think is so important to well-being is that you said, you know, these are the goals that I set for myself, and I'm good. Like, I'm good. I don't need to prove anything to anyone. And that there, to me, is a real sense of, you know, what is in your toolkit, right? What is your mental health? What is the boundary that protects your physical and mental health? So in sport, as in life, many things, you know, have happened that are beyond your control. And it's really about how do you respond to them, right? So you're talking about injuries, and injuries probably fall into that category. So in reading about your story, you've endured a lot of physical pain and it impacted whether you could golf or not. And it sounds like you even questioned whether your body could hold up enough to continue playing. And you've talked about feeling down when the pain became too much. Can you reflect a little bit on those periods of physical pain and tell us what you did to manage your mental health during those times?
Yeah, it was difficult. You know, I got to the point where I got scared to swing. I got scared to hit the white ball because it was just such a sharp pain that it would just hit me like a car accident every single time. And, you know, there was one tournament where my mom literally had to like put my head down on a pillow because, you know, I had a herniated neck. And it's just like stuff like that. It's just hard to, when your body goes into that much shock, I feel like it's just really hard afterwards to swing comfortably and confidently. You know, also another part of that is just, I just felt this like immense feeling of I guess not pain, but just slightly guilt and just feeling like I'm not tough enough. I think it just goes back to, you know, you see photos of ballerinas and their feet are disfigured and you're like, wow, what pain did they have to go through? And then you see just of every other athlete, like showing off their, I mean, it's definitely battling something, you know, I guess to be proud of, but sometimes I feel like when that is showcased so much, I think that can have a detrimental effect as well. It's just one of those mindsets I struggled with. I'm like, okay, like all I had was a herniated neck. That seems like nothing. So it's just a really important, I think, to showcase, you know, how we're feeling in those experiences instead of just like the headlines that read Tiger Woods, you know, won the US Open with a broken knee. You know, I mean, I think those articles are amazing. I think those stories are amazing, but I think that also has, you know, adverse effect as well. Just, you know, with my story personally, I just felt like, okay, that's nothing. I need to push through. Oh, it's hurting. That it's my fault that it's hurting. I need to be better instead of, you know, being like, I need to take time to get my body right. I just had this like weird mental toll on myself.
Yeah, that's a great reframe for all of us, right? It's like we're praised, you're praised for how hurt, how broken can you be and still win, instead of being praised or praising athletes like you all are doing now, sitting back and saying, like, my body is important, my mind is important, and I'm going to take this time to heal and recover and get back to it when I'm ready. It's such a change. It's such a change from the mentality around sport that had existed before. In March of 2021, you played your first tournament as a working mom. And I read about one particular moment during that event where you're about to take a shot, caught a glimpse of your daughter in the distance, and just started to cry. What were you experiencing? What were you thinking in that moment?
It was amazing. You know, she was really part of my journey of coming back. You know, we're deep in the pandemic at that point. We didn't have any help. It was just my husband and I in San Francisco. And I don't know, it just became a routine to bring her out with me and my husband. And when we go play, or, you know, when I would go play nine holes, I would carry my bag and put her in the stroller and walk with her, or in the rain, just kind of set her up there and, you know, do all that. And it was just like, it was cool because it was a moment of how far we'd come. But I think injuries and athletes and kind of that like mindset is very similar to motherhood. You know, I feel like, you know, the mental toll, you know, the physical pain that we're feeling, breastfeeding, postpartum, that's kind of all like, again, you know, brushed under the rug. You know, we're praised for women who have C-sections and they're doing cleaning the dishes the next day. It's like, wow, look how strong you are. And it's just, it's very similar. Us moms, like being pregnant when we're, you know, still bleeding for 6-8 weeks afterwards. And yet, you know, we're praised if we're doing more, instead of really looking at it the other way, being like, okay, what do you need to do? Rest. I mean, it's just a whole, I guess, a social construct. And I've definitely experienced it, you know, just from being pregnant, just it really happens, you know, just being like, you know, people in a really nice way being like, oh, wow, your body snapped back so fast. Yeah. Like, you know, it's just, right, and they don't mean it in a bad way. No. It's a compliment, you know, and it's just, you know, one of those things. It's like, okay, like we aren't, I guess, allowed. I'm not allowed, but I guess we're praised for just snapping back into what we were before, instead of celebrating, you know, every hard step, every, you know, postpartum journey that we're going through, you know, the breastfeeding journey as well. It's just, you know, the shame of using formula versus not being able to breastfeed. It's definitely difficult.
I read a story about you having sort of a eureka moment in terms of feeling like it's time to really raise your voice and use your platform as a public figure to talk about important social issues. I'd love for you to share more about coming into that brave mental space where speaking up starts to feel irrepressible.
Yeah. You know, especially after I had my daughter, you know, everything revolves around, you know, making life for her better and making things easier for her. You know, I've kind of noticed, I guess, you know, staying quiet, you know, in the Asian culture, we're always told to, you know, stay quiet, don't make waves, don't cause trouble. And, you know, I just realized if I stay silent, what kind of effect will that have on my daughter? Will then my daughter not have the confidence to speak up for what she believes in? Because she doesn't have the role model that, you know, that speaks up. So I just felt like sometimes staying silent on certain issues could have an adverse effect on my daughter. I think just showing her, normalizing, you know, the topics around mental health, around, you know, your body, you know, your period every month, normalizing things. I think it's just really important for future generations. And, you know, I just think that when I see, you know, my past generations and, you know, kind of not speaking up, I guess, as much as like the current generation, I think at first it was like, I was scared to do so. I was like, okay, am I, you know, going against my ancestors and what they want me to do? But then I'm just like, okay, this is just going to keep snowballing into the future generation. So everything that I, you know, I'm doing, hopefully for the good of future generations and my daughter.
Yeah, very powerful, especially because your career has traversed this time where, as a nation, as a country, our awareness of, you know, the racism and discrimination against Asian Americans, and you're Korean American, your parents are immigrants. Has that been a scary space to step into? You alluded to the fact that, you know, just kind of historically, is that something that your ancestors would have done? and now that you're here and now that you have this voice and this pedestal, so to speak, do you feel comfortable kind of stepping in there?
I don't think I ever feel comfortable. I just feel like it's necessary now. You know, it's just 2020 was a really unfortunate year, you know, I think for the whole world. But, you know, just with the rise of Asian hate after that, it just really saddens me and it's scary. You know, there are definitely instances where, you know, I felt it personally. And then I just started to kind of think back and I'm like, okay, how did this even happen? How did this all become this? And I just started to realize that it didn't happen overnight. It didn't happen because someone said something and then everyone just turned. It was years and years of microaggressions. It was, and then you look back at the history and it's written all in history, you know, about the discrimination, the hatred, the alienation towards, you know, Asian Americans. And I just started to look back again and be like, okay, even with, you know, with golf, you know, there started to be a time where South Koreans were, you know, all leading the tour. You know, they were number one in the world. And it got to the point that where I would get asked these questions all the time by the media. And I always felt uncomfortable answering them. And, you know, the question was, why are South Koreans so good at golf? It was almost like, you know, it demonizing, you know, South Koreans, that because we were South Korean, we're good at golf and we shouldn't be. So what, why is that? You know, again, those questions, I don't think there were any malice behind it. You know, it could have been a compliment again, but I think that it's just the mindset of microaggressions.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lack of exposure, right? It's an ignorance, but you know, it's even in taking on the role of correcting and educating, that too takes a tax, right? You can't just be here and you know, practice your sport. You're educating as you go along, and that, you know, that impacts mental health as well. I love how you showed public solidarity with Naomi Osaka when she withdrew from the French Open in 2021, citing her own mental health reasons. And you said her decision was incredibly brave, which it was. And then you detailed some of your own experiences with anxiety, which I found really brave too. And because it was a public display of empathy combined with your own personal vulnerability, right? And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to open up a bit more about balancing at times, you know, anxiety and our anxious mind with a life as a professional athlete. How do you sort of deal with that in those internal feelings, but still move forward?
Yeah, I mean, anxiety is the worst. I would have like panic attack at airports, like literally the worst place that could happen. But, you know, it's hard. I mean, I just at times felt like how I played directly reflected who I was as a person. You know, I felt like, you know, when I played bad, when I, you know, would shoot over par and I would like feel happy afterwards, I shut that down so quickly because I felt like I didn't deserve to be happy if I shot bad on the course, which is like, in hindsight, doesn't make sense at all. But when you're going, like, I just felt like when you were around people and you were smiling, but then you like played bad, I felt like that looked bad. I felt like I shouldn't be doing that. And I just like shut that down. I felt like I should just be miserable. So then it just like became this thing where I had anxiety before the round because I knew that the 5 hours that I spent on the golf course dictated the remaining hours that I had left in the day. It was not about, oh, I want to play good because my performance is good and I want to do well. It was I have anxiety about, am I going to be happy or sad the rest of the day? And what is that going to affect? So that was, I had a lot of anxiety around that. And I don't think it was until after I was, you know, really done playing a couple months ago that I realized how dumb that was. But kind of going through that, that was kind of the mindset. And that really raised a lot of anxiety for me.
Wow. It was like you almost couldn't enjoy, right? So if you didn't do well or you didn't win, you couldn't enjoy your sport.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't allowed. And that must be hard, right? You're almost fighting yourself, right?
So totally.
At the end at the end of it, right? At the end of it, you know, what your anxiety was saying to you was that I know that after this is over, I can't be myself, right? And like, what's that internal battle? It must have been so, so hard, right? And for you to go through that. So as you close this chapter, we're seeing you come into more mentorship and leadership work, including a position on the board of directors of the LPGA. And you've also recently joined Nike's athlete think tank. This all points to helping shape the future of women's sports. So in terms of mental health care, what do you want the future to look like for women athletes?
Yeah, you know, I'm so proud. Our tour has, free mental health, hotlines, spaces where we can talk about our mental health. I'm so proud of our tour for implementing that. You know, they always send us surveys like, what are you, what are you thinking about? What are you struggling with? And then, you know, that'll help into, the counselors that talk to us. So I think it's really cool, kind of having mental health days and, freebies when it comes to pro-ams or stuff like that, where, you can go up to a rule official and just explain what you're feeling. And I think it's just more so now than ever, we're able to talk about it. It's not a stigma anymore. Just because you say you have anxiety, you're no longer this broken person. You can be a champion golfer, athlete, person, and still have struggles. There's literally no one in this world that has it all going for them. There's no one in this world that lives life. I mean, I hope there is. I hope there are people, but I just find it really hard to believe that there are people that, don't have anxiety, don't have bad thoughts from time to time. And it's okay. I think that's what I'm learning as well, too, that it's okay. It's okay to have times that you feel like you can't do anything or don't want to do anything. And I hope that resonates with future generations as well.
It's amazing how progressive it sounds like golfing has become, just in this short period of time, because it's recognizing, people like yourself who are saying, I need this, right? This is what I need as an athlete. Everyone has to respond to that when you're vulnerable and open up in that way. So you're a part of that change. So important. So as you've made all these big and important life transitions in your professional and personal life, from motherhood to comebacks to announcing this new phase of your career, what sort of support systems have been helpful to you, and what constitutes now your mental health routine?
My husband is a great support system that I have for me. He is insanely calm. So I'm a very frantic person by nature, I think. I'm learning. I thought I was calm, but I'm not. Compared to him, I'm not. So it's really nice to have, to have someone that I can really, truly talk to. He works with a lot of, basketball players and, sees the day to day. So, he just understands me really deeply. So it's nice to have that support system.
Do you have, now that you're moving sort of out of your golfing routine into your routine of motherhood, into the routine of what's coming next, what would you say constitutes your mental health care routine?
I think it's the same, just watching the series that I like to watch, carving some time for myself, doing my nails, finding some time to work out, play with the dogs. It's hard. You just kind of have to find time. I think the thing with motherhood is that you're never on your own time. It's your child's time, and you kind of move around and, nothing's about you. But I think it's important too. It's important for me to find time to do things that I want to do, but then just like be okay with it. I'm okay with, the messes that we make and, the house not being perfect and all that. I think it's just being able to just take a deep breath.
Yeah.
And to find a minute here and there.
Yeah. So Michelle Wee West, we are watching and we're excited about this next chapter that comes. You've been so impactful in what you've done with your career so far, but just so mindful and centered and grounded. And you've used your voice in such a way that has empowered and continues to empower. So we thank you again for spending time with us here. And are there any last thoughts you have for our listeners?
I would say keeping you, keeping unique, and yeah, don't be afraid to reach out and, you know, say you need help. I think that's the scariest part. I think the first time you do it is the scariest. The more you do it, it just gets easier and easier.
That was Michelle Wee West. Please come back next time when my co-host Natalia Diane and I wrap up the first 10 episodes of No Off Season. We'll reflect on the show's most moving moments. We'll also talk about what makes for an effective crisis counselor in a world that needs as many helpers and volunteers as possible. Crisis Text Line is proud to partner with Nike. We provide free, 24/7, high-quality, text-based mental health support and crisis intervention by empowering a community of trained volunteers to support people in their moments of need. At any time, texters in the U.S. can connect with a volunteer crisis counselor by texting the word STRONG to 741-741. It's brave to reach out. This has been No Off Season. I'm Dr. Shairi Turner. The information and opinions provided on this podcast are not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. We encourage you to speak with your doctor for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.